Welcome back to the deep dive. I want to start today with a feeling.
Okay.
It's a very specific kind of frustration that I think every single person listening right now has felt. Probably in the last week, maybe even this morning, you know?
I think I know where you're going with this.
You turn on the news or you're scrolling through your feed and you just see another conflict erupting.
Right.
Maybe it's a war halfway across the world, or maybe it's a sudden vicious spike in polarization right here at home. And you just get this heavy sinking sense of deja vu.
It's the I've seen this movie before syndrome.
Exactly. It's that feeling that history isn't just rhyming, it's literally screaming the exact same lines over and over again. And the frustrating part, the part that honestly keeps me up at night, is the
The
contrast.
contrast between our technology and our behavior.
Yes. We live in the most advanced era of human history. I mean, we have supercomputers in our pockets. We have more data, more PhDs, more communication tools than any civilization that has ever existed.
Right, we've mapped the human genome.
We are exploring Mars, and yet.
And yet, when it comes to conflict, we seem to revert straight back to the Stone Age.
Right. It's like we have Star Trek technology, but caveman conflict resolution skills.
Yeah.
We just keep stumbling into these cycles of violence and escalation that, when you look back at them 10 years later, they look completely avoidable. They look like tragic
They
farces.
do. And that dissonance,
Yeah.
that specific gap between our intelligence and our actions is exactly what we are unpacking today. Because usually, when we try to explain why this happens, we look for a villain.
Right.
We say, oh, it's that specific bad leader, or it's a battle over oil, or it's because of that one treaty signed in
Yeah,
1990.
we look for the bad apple in the barrel.
We do. We always do. But today's deep dive is going to challenge that instinct pretty hard. We're looking at a fascinating and, frankly, quite challenging piece of research that suggests the problem isn't just out there in the bad guys or the economics.
Ray.
The problem is here. It's in the wiring of our collective minds.
Yeah, so we are diving deep into a white paper that was actually released just today, February 24th, 2026.
Hot off the presses.
Very. It's by Dr. Bechara Saley, and the title is The Invisible Architecture of Violence. And I have to say, right off the bat, the thing that grabbed me wasn't just the content, it was the author's background.
Yeah, that's crucial.
Because Dr. Saley isn't a four-star general. He's not some career politician or a think tank foreign policy guy. He's a physician.
A medical doctor.
Oh, yeah.
And that shift in perspective changes absolutely everything about how you read this paper. Think about how a doctor approaches a patient.
Okay.
If a patient comes into the clinic with a raging fever and a systemic infection, the doctor doesn't judge them. They don't look at the patient and say, you are a wicked person for having a high temperature.
Right. Your fever is a moral failing on your part.
Exactly. A doctor looks for the pathology. They move completely away from blame and entirely into diagnosis. They look at the systems, the immune
Yeah.
system, the circulatory system, and they ask where the failure's occurring.
Where's the breakdown?
Right. And Dr. Saley is applying that exact medical lens to the body politic, to society as a whole.
So instead of asking who is the villain here, we're asking what is the disease?
Precisely. The core analogy in the white paper is that just as a human body can have chronic inflammation or an autoimmune response where it literally attacks itself because it's confused about what is a threat and what isn't, societies have these invisible architectures.
And visible architectures.
Yeah, these are hidden structures that dictate how we react to pain and threat as a group. And most of the time, we don't even know they're there.
So we're just reacting. We think we're making these grand, rational, geopolitical choices, but really we're just coughing because the reflex tells our lungs to cough.
That is a great way to put it. It's a reflex. And before we get into the actual gears of this machine, I want to be very, very clear about the mission of this deep dive today.
Yes, please.
The paper is explicitly nonpartisan. This is not a critique of the political left or the right. It's not an attack on any specific country's foreign policy, whether domestic or abroad. It is a structural critique of how human groups organize themselves, period.
Which is honestly a massive relief, because I think we're all a little burnt out on the my side is perfectly righteous and your side is purely evil
It's
narrative.
exhausting.
It's boring, really. So Dr. Saheeli is saying, let's lift up the hood and look at the actual engine block of human society.
And that engine block has two main components that we really need to understand to grasp his theory. One is what he calls the CMT syndrome, which sounds very medical, and in a sociopolitical sense, it really is.
Okay, CMT syndrome.
And the second component is the ruling group mind.
Okay, those sound like some pretty heavy concepts, so let's take our time with them. I want to start with the CNT syndrome. The paper mentions this borrows from the framework of a peace researcher named Johann Galtung, right?
It does, yes. Galtung is foundational here. Yeah. The way of mapping what they call the collective subconscious.
Okay, hold on. Collective subconscious. I hear that, and it sounds a little, I don't know, a little mystical. Are we getting into telepathy or Jungian magic here?
No, not at all. It's much more practical than that. It's not magic. Think of it as sediment.
Sediment, like dirt.
Like geological layers. Every society has a history, right? Over hundreds of years, you have wars, you have great victories, profound traumas, religious awakenings, famines. All of that history settles into the culture like layers of sediment.
Okay, I can picture that.
It forms the absolute bedrock of our assumptions. It's the stuff you don't even actively think about because it's just the water you swim in.
The default settings of a nation.
Exactly. It's the things that if you were to question them out loud at a dinner party, people would look at you like you had two heads.
Right.
Not because they've logically deduced that you're wrong, but just because we don't question that. That unquestioned bedrock is the collective subconscious. And the CMT syndrome is the specific cocktail, a triad of three elements, that tends to lead societies toward violence.
Okay, CMT. Let's break them down one by one.
Let's do it.
C is for chosenness.
Chosenness. Right.
Now, on the surface, I think I kind of get this. It's the we're number one foam finger. It's national pride. And I have to ask the devil's advocate question here. Is that inherently bad?
What?
I mean, if a country doesn't think it's special, why would anyone pay their taxes or volunteer for the fire department or build infrastructure? Don't you need a little bit of we are special glue just to function as a society?
That is the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And the paper makes a very careful distinction here. And it distinguishes between healthy pride, which is we love our culture, we take care of our own, we like our traditions, and chosenness.
Okay, so what's the difference?
Chosenness is a pathology. It is the deep-seated belief that your group, whether that's your nation, your religion, your specific civilization, is not just good, but uniquely virtuous.
Uniquely.
Yes. Divinely favored, historically destined to lead.
So it's not just I really like my house, it's my house is the only house on the block that God actually likes.
Right. We are the good guys of history. Capital G, capital G. We are the civilizers. We are the beacon. And if you look back, almost every major power in history has had a version of this operating system.
Give me an example.
Well, the Romans believed they were bringing divine order and law to the chaotic barbarians. The British Empire genuinely believed they were bringing commerce, civilization, and Christianity to the savages.
The white man's burden kind of thing?
Exactly.
And when you fundamentally believe you are the protagonist of the universe, that has to change how you view your own actions.
It creates an incredibly dangerous moral loop. Think about it. If we are the chosen ones, then by definition, our intentions are always good.
Right, because we're the good guys.
So if we invade a country, it's not an invasion, it's a liberation. If we kill people, it's not murder, it's cleansing the world of evil or maintaining global stability.
It's like a get-out-of-jail-free card for basic morality.
It's what the paper explicitly calls redemptive violence.
Oh.
The idea that our violence is constructive, surgical, and holy, while their violence is senseless, cruel, and barbaric.
Even if the physical action, dropping a bomb, is exactly the same.
Exactly the same. And this completely traps a society because it makes true self-critique impossible. You cannot look in the mirror and truly see a flaw because that would contradict the core foundational truth that you are the chosen one.
So it blinds you. You literally can't see your own mistakes until it's way, way too late.
You're immune to negative feedback about yourself.
Okay, so that's the C, chosenness. You feel morally superior. But that feeling needs a story to ride on, a vehicle. And that brings us to the M in the syndrome, myth.
Myth. Now, we need to be very careful with this word, because in casual conversation, myth usually just means a lie. Like, it's a myth that you could see the Great Wall of China from space.
Right. A falsehood. Something Snopes would debunk.
Here, in this framework, myth does not mean falsehood. It means organizing narrative.
Yeah.
It is the story a society tells itself about how it came to be. Think about the founding story of almost any nation. It usually follows a very specific, almost cinematic script.
Like the hero's journey.
Exactly like the hero's journey. The script goes, we were oppressed, we struggled in the darkness. Then a great leader or a great movement arose. We fought a righteous underdog battle against the massive forces of evil. We won. And now we stand forever as the guardians of truth and liberty.
It's Star Wars.
It is quite literally Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem isn't that the story is entirely false. Usually there are very real elements of truth in it. Real battles were sought. Real sacrifices were made.
Right, it's not made out of whole cloth.
No. The problem is that the story is simplified. Real history is incredibly, wonderfully messy. It's full of accidents, betrayals, deep moral gray areas, and moments where our side did some pretty horrific things to get that victory.
But you can't exactly put all those messy betrayals and atrocities on a commemorative bronze plaque in the town square.
You can't. So the myth acts like a Hollywood film editor. It cuts the scenes that don't fit the heroic narrative. It smooths over all the nasty contradictions. It creates a clean, beautiful, upward arc.
The director's cut, where the hero is utterly flawless.
And here's the trap. This is where it gets dangerous. When you raise an entire population on that myth, generation after generation, and then facts emerge that challenge it, what happens?
What kind of facts?
Say, a historian uncovers undeniable evidence of a massacre committed by the nation's beloved founding fathers, or a whistleblower reveals that a recent righteous war was actually started on entirely false pretenses.
Oh, I see.
When that happens, what is the reaction of the society?
Well, ideally, in a perfectly rational world, you'd say, oh, wow, we were wrong about that. Let's update our historical view and do better.
Ideally, yes.
Yeah.
But if your entire collective identity, your sense of who you are, is built entirely on the myth, you physically cannot do that. The cognitive dissonance is too painful. It literally feels like a psychological death.
Because it is a death of the ego.
Yes. So instead of rejecting the myth to accommodate the facts, the society rejects the facts to protect the myth.
Wow.
They attack the historian. They jail or exile a whistleblower. They double down on the story, often with intense anger.
Because if the story dies, we die. Or at least the version of ourselves that we love dies.
Exactly. The myth becomes a rigid intellectual cage. So now if we look at the syndrome, we have chosenness, we are the absolute best, and myth, we have a spotless, perfect story.
Right.
But there's a third element, and this is the one that gives the whole system its explosive, dangerous power. T is for trauma.
Trauma. Now, we talk about individual trauma all the time these days. It's very much in the cultural zeitgeist. PTSD, triggers, therapy words. Yeah. But Dr. Saley is talking about collective trauma, right?
Yes. And this is a vital distinction.
Yeah.
He points out that almost every modern state currently on the map was forged in profound violence. Revolutions, brutal civil wars, colonial occupations, famines, genocide.
Blood on the soil.
Tons of it.
Yeah.
And these massive events don't just happen and then vanish into the history books. They leave a deep psychic scar on the culture itself.
It's like a ghost in the machine.
It creates a structural hypersensitivity to threat.
Mm.
To use a clinical analogy, imagine a person who was violently assaulted, badly beaten up in an alleyway 10 years ago.
Okay.
Today, they are walking down a perfectly safe, well-lit street in a good neighborhood, but someone behind them accidentally drops a glass bottle. It shatters. What does that person do?
They jump out of their skin. They panic. They might even swing a punch or run before they consciously know what they're doing.
Right. The reaction is entirely disproportionate to the current reality. It was just a dropped bottle. But it is perfectly proportionate to the memory of the trauma.
That makes total sense.
Societies do the exact same thing on a macro scale.
So a nation that was devastatingly invaded 100 years ago might be obsessively, intensely paranoid about its borders today, even if its neighbors are peaceful.
Exactly. Or a nation that suffered a massive historical humiliation on the world stage might become completely obsessed with respect and projecting strength to the point of outright aggression.
They overcompensate.
The paper argues that unintegrated, unprocessed trauma makes a society constantly afraid of reversal. We are terrified that what was done to us will happen again.
Or, wait, if we are the ones who did the bad thing.
Yes. Or conversely, we are terrified that what we did to others will finally be done to us.
Retribution.
Deep down, the perpetrator always fears the victim's revenge. So you have this triad. Chosenness gives you the moral high ground. Myth gives you the unshakable script. And trauma provides the raw emotional fuel, the adrenaline, the fear, the hair trigger reflex.
It's like a dormant volcano. It just sits there looking peaceful, maybe for decades. You build towns on it. But the geology is all wrong underneath. And the moment a crisis hits,
it activates. The triad effect kicks in. And this is where the paper moves from psychology, which is fascinating, into hard politics. Because you as a listener might be asking right now, okay, this is all very interesting, you know, Freud stuff, collective subconscious stuff, but how does this actually start a real war.
Right. How does this control a government? Governments are full of rational bureaucrats in suits holding meetings. The State Department runs on memos and cost-benefit analyses, not deep psychic feelings. Or at least, we pretend it does.
We very much pretend it does. But Dr. Sally argues that this underlying psychology actually creates a rigid institutional structure.
Mm-hmm.
He uses a term coined by John McMurtry, the ruling group mind.
Okay, ruling group mind. I have to be honest, when I read that term in the paper, it made me a little nervous. It sounds dangerously close to conspiracy theory territory. Like, are we talking about the Illuminati, a smoke-filled room where five guys in dark suits decide what the rest of us are allowed to think?
It's funny you say that, because the paper explicitly addresses that exact fear.
Yeah.
Humans actually love conspiracy theories.
They do. Why?
Because they are deeply comforting.
Comforting. That there's a shadowy cabal.
Yes. Because if there is a smoke-filled room, then at least someone is in charge.
Oh.
It means there's a steering wheel. We can find the bad guys. We can kick down the door, arrest them, and fix the world.
Right. It implies a plan, even an evil one, which is less scary than chaos.
Exactly. But the reality of the group mind is actually much scarier than a conspiracy. There is no conspiracy. There is no one in the room. There is no steering wheel.
Then what is it?
The group mind is a cognitive operating system. It is the sum total of professional norms, media incentive structures, political boundaries, and social taboos that organically govern what is considered thinkable in a society.
It's the software running quietly on the servers.
Exactly. And it strictly determines the boundaries of the conversation. Think about it. In any society, there are things you can readily say and things you simply cannot say if you want to remain a serious person in polite company.
The Overton window.
It is the Overton window, but enforced by deep psychological defense mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
The paper identifies three specific mechanisms the group mind uses to keep us all in line.
Okay, let's go through them.
The first one is projection.
Which goes back to the medical metaphor, right? Psychological projection.
Yes. Projection is a classic defense mechanism. If I'm a deeply insecure person, I might constantly accuse everyone else around me of being weak. Structurally, at a national level, this happens when a society has deep internal contradictions.
Give me a structural example.
Let's say a nation claims to value freedom and human rights. Above all else, that's its myth, right? But its economy secretly relies on exploiting cheap, borderline slave labor abroad. That creates a massive internal tension.
Cognitive dissonance again. We feel like hypocrites even if we don't say it out loud.
And we absolutely hate feeling like hypocrites. It threatens the chosenness. So to manage that severe discomfort, the group mind obsessively focuses the public's attention on the crimes of other nations.
Look over there.
Exactly. Look at how that regime treats their workers. Look at their lack of freedom. They are monsters.
So the more we point the finger out there at them, the less we have to look in the mirror over here.
It is a brilliant deflection strategy, and it works perfectly. It rallies the public against an external enemy, which conveniently distracts from the internal rot.
It explains why foreign policy is often so incredibly moralistic. We need a cartoon villain to prove to ourselves that we are the heroes.
Precisely.
Okay, what's the second mechanism of the group mind?
The second is taboo and policing dissent. This is what the paper calls the cognitive firewall. In a free modern society, you usually don't have a secret police dragging people away in the middle of the night just for asking questions.
Right, no gulags.
Instead, we have something much more subtle and efficient. We have stigma.
Social shaming.
Exactly. Certain questions, while perfectly legal to ask, are instantly labeled toxic. If a conflict breaks out and you ask, hey, why do those people hate us? Is it possible our historical policies harmed them and contributed to this?
Yeah.
You immediately get labeled.
Oh, yeah. You get hit with, you're an apologist for terror, you're unpatriotic, you're naive.
You're blaming the victim.
Right.
These labels are designed to do one thing, shut down the thought process. They signal to everyone else watching, do not go there. That is a dangerous thought. You will lose your status if you engage with it.
And people care about their status.
Deeply. So ambitious journalists, politicians, academics, they all learn to self-censor. They stay safely within the designated lane.
So the fierce debate we see on TV, which looks like a really vigorous free speech debate between two opposing sides, is actually taking place within an incredibly tiny pre-approved sliver of reality.
Correct. The group mind filters out all the contextual noise that might disrupt the myth.
That is wild. Okay, so that's projection and taboo. What is the third mechanism?
The third is fragmentation.
Now, this one really hit home for me because of how I personally consume the news every morning.
It's the siloing of information. In our modern media diet, we have a business section that talks analytically about oil prices, supply chains, and defense contracts.
Right.
Then we have a foreign policy section that talks emotionally about national security, democratic ideals, and threats. Then we have a history channel that talks about things that happened 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But we rarely, if ever, connect them in real time.
We don't see the web.
We don't see the web.
Yeah.
We don't see how the defense contract discussed in the business section is actively driving the national security panic in the policy section, which is fundamentally rooted in the unhealed trauma from the history section.
We treat them as totally separate worlds.
And this keeps the public perpetually confused. It forces us to focus solely on the symptoms, the explosion that happened yesterday, the angry speech by a dictator, the immediate crisis rather than the structural historical disease causing it.
It keeps us shallow. We are just surfing the chaotic waves of daily events, but we never dive down to see the massive deep sea currents that are actually driving the ocean.
And that shallow focus is incredibly dangerous. Because when a real crisis actually hits, when the proverbial balloon goes up, that shallow understanding allows the system to accelerate into violence at a terrifying speed.
Let's talk about that speed, because this leads us into part three of the paper, the physiology of crisis. It feels to me like the timeline for decision-making has totally collapsed in the modern era.
It has.
It used to be that wars brewed for months or years. Armies had to march. Ambassadors sent letters by boat. Now it feels like we can go from relative peace to missiles in the air in 48 hours.
Dr. Selahill uses another brilliant medical metaphor here to explain this acceleration. The amygdala hijack.
The lizard brain.
Right. The amygdala is the ancient fear center of your brain. Its only job is to keep you alive in the next 10 seconds. When a tiger jumps out of the bushes, the amygdala instantly takes over. It completely shuts down the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of your brain responsible for logic, nuance, empathy, and long-term planning.
Because you don't need nuance when you're fighting a tiger.
Exactly. You don't pause to consider the tiger's socioeconomic background. You need speed. You run or you fight. Thinking is fatal.
Okay, so how does that scale up to a whole country?
The paper argues that societies possess a collective amygdala. When a sudden threat appears on the news, a terrorist attack, a sudden border incursion, a bomb ship, the group mind instantly shifts into collective survival mode. And in survival mode, complexity is literally perceived as danger.
Explain that a bit more. Why is complexity dangerous in a crisis?
Because complexity causes hesitation. If you stop the momentum to ask, wait, what is the deep historical context here? What are the long-term economic implications of bombing them?
Question.
That you are slowing down the tribe's reaction time.
And the tribe hates that.
The tribe demands immediate unity. It demands action. So in that moment, nuance looks exactly like weakness. It looks like treason.
It's the rally around the flag effect.
And it is a powerful drug. It feels incredibly good. Suddenly, all our annoying internal political bickering disappears. We are one people. We have a clear, easily definable enemy. The low-level chronic anxiety of modern life is instantly replaced by a singular, burning, righteous purpose.
But today, that ancient tribal mechanism is running on the fiber optic cables of the internet.
And that is the ultimate accelerant. Social media algorithms and 24-hour news networks are literally built to run on emotional contagion. The paper maps out this catastrophic loop. Threat signal occurs. Emotional spike follows. Media amplification kicks in because fear drives engagement and sells ads.
Which leads to higher threat perception.
Exactly. It's an endless feedback loop that just screams louder and louder with every cycle.
So a rigid consensus forms before the actual facts are even remotely in.
Long before the dust has even settled on the ground, the group mind has already decided this is an unprovoked act of war. They are pure evil and we must destroy them.
And this leads to a phenomenon the paper describes as the vanishing of alternatives. I found this profound because I've seen it happen in my own lifetime.
We all have.
In the heat of the moment, diplomatic options, things that seemed totally reasonable and standard just a week prior, suddenly look completely unrealistic.
The policy horizon massively contracts. It's like tunnel vision. Suddenly, the only thing that looks like doing something is kinetic force.
Right.
Force is loud. Force is tangible. It plays well on television. Diplomacy is quiet, it's slow, it involves compromise, and it's deeply uncertain. So during an amygdala hijack, diplomacy looks like doing nothing. It looks like surrender.
I was actually thinking about this while prepping for the show. How often do we look back at a massive conflict, say 10 or 20 years later, and ask, why didn't we just talk to that guy? Why didn't we just make that one minor territorial concession? It would have saved a million lives.
And the tragic answer is, at the time, that option was structurally invisible. The group mind had literally rendered it unthinkable. We physically couldn't see the diplomatic off-ramp because we were driving 100 miles an hour down the highway with our hair on fire.
Wow. So let's recap where we are. We have the psychology, the CMT syndrome, which is the loaded gun. We have the institution, the group mind, which is the finger pulling the trigger. And we have the amygdala mobilization. Now let's look at the result of all this. Part four, the vicious cycle.
This is the recursive loop. And it's deeply tragic because it is mathematically predictable.
Walk us through the steps.
Step one, unresolved collective trauma plus the identity myth creates a dormant, simmering hostility.
A sudden threat triggers the group mind and the amygdala hijack.
We react rapidly and reflexively with massive violence or economic coercion because we've convinced ourselves there is no other choice.
And this is the real kicker, trauma multiplication.
Trauma multiplication? I mean, that sounds like a mathematical formula for absolute misery.
It is, because when we lash out in a panic, under the guise of chosenness, we inevitably create new victims.
Right.
We bomb a village to eliminate a terrorist cell. We might actually get the terrorist, but in the process, we create 50 orphans who now have a completely valid burning grievance against us.
We solved the immediate tactical problem, but we just fed the long-term strategic monster.
Exactly. We have quite literally planted the seeds for the next war. And worse, we have validated their myth, their story that we are the evil, oppressive empire.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We deeply fear that they hate us, so we bomb them to make ourselves safe, which makes them actually hate us, which proves to us that we were right to fear them in the first place.
And the snake just eats its own tail forever. But the paper points out another cost, a domestic cost, that we almost always ignore when we talk about geopolitics. This cycle causes severe cognitive fatigue at home.
Cognitive fatigue? What does that look like in the general public?
It means people get exhausted. Deep down, citizens sense the contradiction.
Even if they can't articulate it.
Right. They hear the myth from their leaders. We are the ultimate peacemakers. We are the good guys spreading democracy. But they see the reality on their screens. Endless, grinding wars, broken veterans returning home, trillions of dollars wasted while domestic infrastructure crumbles. And that massive gap between the story and the reality creates a profound psychic exhaustion.
It breeds cynicism.
Total corrosive cynicism. The public starts to think, they're all liars. The media, the politicians, the generals, nothing matters. Trust in core institutions totally collapses. And when institutional trust collapses, the actual fabric of democracy becomes incredibly fragile.
So the war out there actually rots and destroys the society in here.
It erodes the very values we explicitly claim to be defending. But the system has one final, desperate defense mechanism to stop us from fully realizing this. It's a concept called moral inversion.
Okay, this was a really tough concept for me when reading the paper. Break it down for us.
Moral inversion is how the group mind justifies the horror to itself. It is the baked-in belief that our violence is necessary stability, while their violence is savage terrorism.
So if we drop a bomb from a drone that accidentally kills a family of civilians, it's a tragic error or unavoidable collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
But if they set off a bomb that kills civilians, it's a sick crime against humanity.
Precisely. And I want to be very clear here because this is subtle. This isn't just cynical politicians consciously lying to the public.
It's not.
No, it's a psychological necessity for the group mind to survive. If we truly admitted that our violence was just as ugly, just as red, just as devastating and painful as theirs, the entire myth of chosenness would instantly collapse.
I wouldn't be the good guys anymore.
We'd just be, guys. Just another violent tribe fighting for resources in the dirt. And the collective ego simply cannot survive that downgrade in status. So it subconsciously inverts the morality to protect the identity.
Wow. Okay. I feel like we have done a very, very thorough job of diagnosing the patient here.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the diagnosis is rough.
It's heavy.
We have chronic systemic inflammation, ancient unresolved trauma, a nervous system that constantly hijacks the brain, and a grandiose delusion that we are invincible and perfect. If I were the patient sitting in the doctor's office, I'd be asking, Doc, is it terminal?
It really feels terminal when you map it out like this. But this is exactly where Dr. Sahili pivots in the paper. The last section is titled The Way Out, and he is surprisingly genuinely hopeful.
Really? after all that.
Yes, because he argues that since this is an architecture, it can be renovated. It's not a hard law of physics like gravity. It's a set of entrenched psychological habits.
And habits can be broken. He calls the ultimate solution reflective governance.
Yes, as opposed to reflex governance, moving from the knee-jerk amygdala reaction to the conscious prefrontal choice.
Okay, that sounds great on paper. But how? We've been doing this for, what, 5,000 years of recorded human history? How do we practically break a cycle that old?
He lays out a few concrete pillars. The first is accepting universal responsibility. He stresses over and over that we have to stop looking for the bad nation. This is a human bug.
It's universal.
It's in our evolutionary code. We evolved to be tribal. We evolved to react to sudden threats quickly. But the problem is, now we have nuclear weapons and AI. The exact software that worked perfectly to keep the tribe alive on the savannah is now lethal for the entire planet.
So we all have the disease, every nation.
We all have it, which means we all have to take the medicine. And the first most bitter pill to swallow is processing collective trauma.
This honestly sounds like the hardest part. The paper calls it integrating the shadow.
It is absolutely the hardest part. It means a nation has to be willing to look at its own history without the myth filter. We have to acknowledge the historic harms we have suffered, which, to be fair, we are usually very loud about, but we also have to acknowledge the harms we have inflicted.
That feels almost impossible for a modern politician to do. Admitting fault on a national scale is seen as total political suicide.
Currently, under the old group mind, yes, it is. But think about the incredible power of it. Imagine if a world leader stands up and says, "We have made terrible mistakes. We have caused real pain in the past. We are not perfect, but we are trying to be responsible today."
It completely bursts the balloon of chosenness.
It does. But counterintuitively, it also completely disarms the enemy. If you openly admit your flaws, the enemy can no longer use them as a secret weapon against you. You take away the entire power of their propaganda. You don't have to defensively protect a lie anymore.
It takes the pressure off the system.
Yeah.
You can just be real.
Exactly. And that leads to the second solution, reframing chosenness. Dr. Saheeli knows human nature. You can't just mandate to a population, stop feeling special. People need identity. They need a story to belong to. But you can strategically shift the narrative of that story.
Shift it from, "We are the absolute best," to, "We have a unique duty."
Exactly. Shift the definition of greatness from domination to stewardship. If you want to be the chosen ones, fine. Then act like it. Be the ones who exercise immense restraint. Be the ones who build alliances. Be the ones who refuse to escalate when baited.
That perfectly connects to the third solution, which is about the actual day-to-day mechanics of government. He calls for building institutional speed bumps.
This is my favorite part of the paper because it's so wildly practical. If we medically know that the amygdala hijack happens fast, we need to artificially build systems that force us to slow down.
Like a mandatory cooling off period for buying a handgun, but scaled up for declaring war.
Exactly. Mechanisms that legally force deliberation. Hard rules that say, "We cannot take military action for X number of days until these three completely independent bodies have publicly reviewed the intelligence."
Right.
Or robust legal safeguards that fiercely protect political dissenters during a sudden crisis, so the group mind doesn't immediately silence the exact people who might save us from making a catastrophic mistake.
We need to engineer literal pauses into the system. Break the feedback loop.
We need to interrupt the contagion. And finally, all of this culminates in a completely new definition of strength.
I think that this is probably the most important takeaway for the listeners today, because we have a very, very specific idea in our culture of what a strong leader looks like.
Oh, yeah. The John Wayne archetype.
Right.
Rapid reaction, absolute moral certainty, crushing the opposition with overwhelming force. Never, ever apologizing.
I don't doubt myself.
And Dr. Saheeli argues that in a highly complex, globally interconnected world, that kind of rigid strength is actually incredibly brittle. It breaks things. It leads directly to disaster.
So what does new strength look like?
New strength is the high-level capacity for self-critique. It's the emotional tolerance for complexity and gray areas. It's the intellectual ability to hold two opposing thoughts in your head at the exact same time without panicking. And most importantly, it is the profound ability to exercise restraint when you are actively provoked.
But restraint is usually framed by the media as weakness. You know, You let them get away with it. You look sauced.
But think about the actual internal discipline it takes. It takes infinitely more raw courage to sit in a room and negotiate while the public mob outside is screaming for blood than it does to simply cave to the amygdala and order a drone strike. The adult in the room is actually the strongest person there.
The adult in the room, that is the goal.
That's the ultimate goal, to move from a childish, reactive, traumatized way of being in the world to a mature, reflective, and responsible way of being.
Man, it really feels like we've been on a massive journey today.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. We started with that everyday feeling of deja vu, the frustration of watching the endless cycle on the news. Then we unpacked the invisible architecture, the CMT syndrome, which is chosenness, myth, and trauma. We looked at the enforcer of the system, the rule and group mind. We saw the devastating cost, the endless loop of recursive violence.
And thankfully, we saw the way out, reflective governance.
The central thesis of the whole paper really sticks with me. I wrote it down here. What remains unconscious at the collective level becomes behavioral at the structural level.
Yeah. If we don't deal with our historical ghosts, our ghosts will literally write our foreign policy.
It is haunting. Really haunting.
Yeah.
But also empowering in a way. Because ghosts only have power in the dark, right?
Yeah.
Once you turn the light on, they're just memories. They can't hurt you.
Exactly. Patterns are not destiny. Biology is not destiny. We culturally built this architecture over centuries, which means we have the power to renovate it.
So we always like to leave you, our listeners, with a challenge, something to carry into your week and chew on.
And here is the challenge for this deep dive. The next time a major crisis unfolds on the news, and unfortunately it will, and you feel that rush.
You know the exact one.
The sudden spike of anger, the absolute moral certainty, the intense feeling that they are evil and we must destroy them immediately.
When the collective amygdala starts knocking loudly on your door.
Stop. Take a literal physical breath and ask yourself one simple question. Is this my thought? Is this my genuine, reasoned, individual reaction? Or is the invisible architecture thinking for me?
Am I actually thinking, or am I just being mobilized?
That is the ultimate question.
And hey, don't be afraid of the answer. Awareness is the very first step to breaking the cycle. Because staying well-informed isn't just about knowing all the facts and dates. It's about knowing yourself.
I couldn't agree more.
Thank you for diving deep with us today. This was a heavy one, but I think a truly essential one. Keep asking the hard questions. Keep checking your own internal architecture. And we'll see you on the next deep dive.
Stay curious, everyone.